Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast. Here we explore spiritual insights and practical strategies to help you cultivate a family life rooted in beautiful, self-giving love. Join us as we invite experts to share uplifting perspectives and actionable advice for navigating the joys and challenges of modern family dynamics. Welcome back to the Ferris Love Podcast. Today, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Timothy O'Malley to the podcast. Dr. O'Malley is a theologian, author, and director of education at the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, where he also serves as academic director of the Notre Dame Center for Liturgy. He's written extensively on liturgy, sacramental theology, and the formation of Catholic culture. And today, we'll be discussing the role of faith and the family in shaping good citizens, and how the home, as a domestic church, forms the foundation for civic responsibility, virtue, and engagement with the world. So Dr. O'Malley, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Mary Grace. Great to be here.
So we would just like to dive in and kind of talk about how the Catholic Church in itself and how our faith helps shape our understanding of what it means to kind of be a good citizen in the midst of our communities.
Yeah, it's a complicated question, right? I mean, if you pay attention to scripture, right, citizenship is certainly Greco-Roman citizenship at the time was ambiguous, right? I mean, Christians were certainly lived in social context. They didn't have any dreams, for example, in St. Paul of changing the Greco-Roman Empire at a political level, but they sort of were like, well, we're going to dwell here and wait for the second coming of our Lord. And, you know, as time develops and tradition develops, Christians have to develop different accounts of what is linked to politics, right? And so what it means to dwell as Christians in a political order. You can kind of think of monks, interestingly, as challenging political orders, as strange as it sounds. But, you know, if most of society is dedicated to reproducing society, suddenly you have these totally useless people who go live in deserts and they don't contribute economically or financially, and they offer a kind of different politics. You know, as Christianity develops, of course, it sometimes gets connected to empire. Those have been really complicated connections that have resulted. And, you know, today, I think the church has a fairly robust sense of, you know, well, Catholics have an identity. We have to dwell in the city. And, you know, that's our responsibility. There are lots of different ways to dwell in the city. So the church is very careful, right? You know, not everything is a American liberal democracy, right? There are totalitarian regimes that Catholics have to dwell in. And there are, you know, sort of quasi monarchies that Catholics have to dwell in, and all are possible. But the church sort of sees a particular sort of gift that no matter where we dwell in the world, we have a responsibility to witness to Jesus Christ as the source of peace, of love, of communion, versus the sort of logic of power and prestige, fame and fortune that seems to operate so much of what might be, for example, American politics today.
How would you, so you mentioned kind of Christianity and the early Christians and how, you know, it was a little different back then and how it is now. How would you describe the role of the family in regards to, so we have the Catholic Church and then we have the family within the Catholic Church. How would you describe that as the role of the family in forming those good citizens?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I think a lot of people think about Catholic social teaching or doctrine, and they think about, okay, so subsidiarity, like things should be handled at the local level, or the common good, right? Your good and my good are the same. And in fact, when you suffer, I suffer, right? This sort of account. If you read the compendium on Catholic social doctrine, I think one thing that's fascinating about it is that the family is featured prominently there. And part of it has to deal with, you know, actually when Catholic social teaching or doctrine emerges, right? And actually under Leo XIII, of course, in Rerum Novarum, but other texts. And, you know, there's a lot of stress of the state upon the family, right? Saying, okay, this is a particular way you have to be a citizen. And that's actually almost more important than your identity as a family. And the church upheld throughout this process that actually family life is more integral or primordial to the state or polis. And so in that sense, right, I think the compendium on Catholic social doctrine is pretty clear on this, right? Is that we learn to be human in the family. That's the first thing. Now, it's not always a good education, I should say, but ideally it ought to be. And what do we learn there? We learn, you know, how to care for one another. We learn about the importance of caring most of all for those who are weak, right? I mean, you have a new sibling and you're supposed to care for that sibling. Mm-hmm. We learn what it means to participate in processes of dialogue, of forgiveness, of listening, of dwelling with those you don't always want to dwell with. You know, and so in that sense, I think a lot of the dispositions of real citizenship, right, are lived out in the context of the family. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, right, the church has just been very clear that it's the state cannot proclaim a more primordial authority than that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the basis. So, you know, the compendium of social doctrine underlines this, and certainly it was upheld by Pope Francis, you know, Pope Benedict and John Paul II, all of mm-hmm. whom underline this fact.
Mm-hmm. And do you think I love how you gave those examples of all the ways that our family reflects that citizenship and that community as a whole. Do you have any virtues that come to your mind that are required for family life to help then build strong citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I think both intellectual and personal humility is sort of operative in most families, right? You're wrong. I mean, you know, I as a dad have extraordinary power in my family right now since I have young children, 12-year-old and an 8-year-old. And I certainly have the ability to simply say, this is how it's going to be, get over it, right? And to operate a kind of power of politics. And I can sort of double down when I'm wrong, right? I mean, I'm the adult. And yet, I think one of the key things that the family upholds is like, no, you can be wrong. And you can have like not a full grasp or understanding of the truth. And that you could operate in such a way that actually doesn't lead to the common good within the family, even as a dad or a parent, and that you actually have to apologize and make some sort of rectification or some sort of, to heal that wound. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge disposition or virtue that's needed in the political world today, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's the opposite of what happens, right? I was wrong. No, I double down. I can't be wrong. How could I be wrong? Because I am elected to this office. And therefore, because of that election, my capacity for wrongness has disappeared. And, you know, I think that degree of dwelling with intellectual and personal humility, I think is essential to family life.
Yeah, humility. And you mentioned earlier about how we are now like in the world. Like, obviously, you have the monastic life, which was kind of contrary to what was going on, you know, back in the day. But now we have the majority of people today live in the world. And how can we face kind of the contradictions of, you know, our faith when we see them out in the world, while also kind of maintaining that like strength and understanding that, okay, charity, you know, all those virtues that we're taught in the faith can still survive in the midst of all those contradictions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is to remind families, I think, in the church that we actually do have political responsibilities or civic responsibilities. I think there is a temptation for the family, especially in American life today, to be treated as some sort of romantic enclave that allows us to escape from the world, right? So we have our nice little space, you know, we make money, we go to Disney World, you know, we have nice vacations and, you know, the rest of the world be damned. You know, our family's doing fine. And I think, again, it's John Paul II who's so clear on this in his writings on the family, whether his letter to families or Familiaris Consortio, right? Mm-hmm. Families have a social responsibility. And that means that families have to transform and make the world a space of love and charity and communion. And there's all sorts of ways that this isn't, that the world isn't that, and that families have a role here. You know, one of my favorite examples Pope Francis gave, it was very marginal or small, but the way that families provide often in urban cities where there's a lot of like seriousness and busyness, this space of smile and wonder and contemplation. I mean, just to concretize that, I think there's something deeply political about an infant or a child, a toddler being running around an airport on a moving walkway. Everyone's acting so serious as if we're involved in some really cosmic saving event as we're mm-hmm. getting on our flights. And this child, all this child wants to do is ride the moving walkway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in that sense, you know, that's a very basic sense, but even more, right, we have responsibility for the poor in our cities, the lonely, mm-hmm. those who don't know love. And to enter into those spaces and to create spaces of love, families mm-hmm. are particularly good at this. We live in neighborhoods. We live with other people. Certainly we live among each other. But I should say that all of this takes a really intensive formation of the family, right? It doesn't take away the spiritual life of the family, the interpersonal relationship development that's needed. In fact, it doubles down on those needs precisely because there's responsibilities in the world.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you don't have to get too personal if you don't want to, but I'm just curious, you said you have a son or you have two children that are 12 and
8.
Yes. So how does that look with your children of knowing like you have probably instilled in them some pretty great, you know, virtues and just a knowledge of their faith. But then how do you help them to bring that about in their own circumstances, whether that's with kids that don't share their same beliefs or, you know, like things. I'm curious if you can share a little bit about that. I don't know if you've come across that yet or.
Yeah, we certainly do. Yeah. I mean, I should say, you know, people who talk about things sometimes are like on their way to trying to do them. And that's why they talk about them. So, you know, I think it is challenging. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm really strong with our children, especially our daughter who has a mm-hmm. certain consumer mindset, right? We mm-hmm. live in a somewhat affluent community and she's used to being like, this person has this, this person has mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And actually, it results ultimately in a kind of lack of gratitude. So I'm very emphatic that, like, no, we don't get everything. And not getting everything is fine, and you're going to be okay. And we don't compare ourselves to those families mm-hmm. because of that. And, you know, we talk a lot about those who lack needs and mm-hmm. those who go without and what our responsibilities for that is. We could be better about actually serving those folks. Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge and really making time to do that in our lives, mm-hmm. spending time with people who are not, you know, who go to the same, some people who don't go to the same schools or people who are in need. And so, you know, we're pretty emphatic on it and we're challenging on it. I mean, our poor daughter is like desperate. She's 8. And of course, friends are starting to get cell phones and things like that because we live in this world where that's what unfolds. And you know, we just tell our children that that's not happening and we have no idea when they're going to get a cell phone, but it's not for a long time. And it's going to make us totally uncool. And, but that's part of our value is like, we think that this will do harm for you. We think that this has other social consequences and political consequences, mm-hmm. and you're just going to be lame nerds and you're going to have to learn to deal with it.
Yeah. And that's okay. In the end, they'll be grateful for it.
Yeah, and here's the other thing about being a lame nerd is that eventually, like, you get rewarded for that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just have to get outside of high school and then you recognize that all of these hierarchies were made up to begin with.
Yeah, there you go. Truth bomb right there. Wow. Oh, that's great. So I'm curious, you know, you have such an extensive understanding of, you know, church teaching and all that. And I think that's really... We love to hear kind of those experts come on our show and just kind of share some of that with us. And you mentioned Rerum Novarum and you've mentioned, you know, JP2 and some of the things that there was another document you said as well. But I am curious just in discussing kind of in looking at our landscape currently right now within the Catholic Church, but then also outside of the church, what areas do you see that we could strengthen kind of our understanding of either church teaching or just, I guess, virtue, charity, so what areas do you see that we could strengthen in that so that we can then become, like stronger families in the midst of this culture?
Yeah. You know, I teach this big class at Notre Dame. So I teach this course on marriage and family. I have 265 undergraduates every fall. Yeah. So it's a sort of a petri dish of, you know, experimentation with, you know, what are the views of an undergraduate, you know, of an 18 to 22 year old, primarily, probably a Catholic. I mean, 84% of our students, 83% are Catholic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, of course, right, everybody, when they think about church teachings around these things, they think about, okay, sort of contraception, they think about, you know, Eucharistic belief or understanding or evangelization or commitment to Christ. And, you know, what I've come more and more sure of teaching this course is that actually the fundamental problem is something that Gaudium et Spes, the Second Vatican Council's constitution on the modern world said, which was this, that there is amongst most people today a radical gap between faith and the rest of their lives. And this is especially the case in the United States, where religion is ultimately and primarily a private event for Sunday mornings. And, you know, I think the great challenge is actually to introduce to persons today that there is a fundamental relationship between your family life, your work life, your political life, and your religious life. And that rather than think about those as disintegrated entities, those are one, right? So it's not the case that you're like, okay, the religious part of my family is that I have to sometimes think about raising my kids by taking them to church and getting them first communion. Mm-hmm. It should fundamentally change the totality of what it means to be a parent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it brings in all those dimensions. I was talking about forgiveness earlier. That's what I'm talking about, right? It's fundamental to the kind of culture or world that's set up. Same thing with work. You know, a lot of my undergraduates, you know, they are like many people of this generation under the presumption that the major thing they will do with their lives is work, and they're going to work hard and long hours. And they have a kind of almost Pollyannish belief that somehow after working 70 hours a week, that they're suddenly going to be able to also raise their kids with ease and that there are going to be no consequences for this. You can really have it all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's where an integration works, is to say, okay, if, for example, Catholicism is the central dimension of my life, if Jesus Christ is the essential dimension of my life, then it also changes how I view work and the kind of decisions I make about work and for the sake of my family. So, I mean, I think that's it. How do we explode this gap between faith and life that seems so pervasive, I think, particularly in American culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any solutions to that? Where you think? I mean, you have that class, which is excellent for undergrads taking. But I'm curious if you have, like, because I agree with you 100%. I think, yeah, we have this disconnect. There's like a disunity in our life, and so how do we work to, you know, be in the world but not of the world, but also, you know,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think in some sense, starting to actually think about it, right? Mm-hmm. So like, oh, this, I actually do live an integrated life, do I? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm always shocked when I ask my undergraduates how you raise your family or your work life, how central will your religious identity be to that? And they're always like, peripheral, right? I mean, those are different things. So, you know, I think raising the awareness is key, but then also, you know, I think there are ways the church can contribute here. So I think about homilies. Now, not everybody goes to Mass, but still people do, and they have to hear homilies. And I have found homilies often very short on the practical dimensions of life, right? So the more that religious persons connect, like some relationship between the sanctification and changing diapers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this stunning thing. I have my undergraduates read it by, you know, this might get me in trouble, but whatever, Martin Luther. And he was actually speaking at the time to those who were a little bit concerned that, you know, by raising kids, they would be sacrificing really important career and life and religious life. And he said, you know, dads in particular, like, understand that there's no more sacred duty you can have than to change the diaper of this child. And, you know, and a lot of my undergrads are shocked. They're like, oh my gosh, this is what Luther is saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that the more that the church talked about those sort of very basic things, I mean, I don't know how, I often hear like, families are important or we should be really good families, but I don't hear a lot of homilists capable of being particular with this, you know. Mm-hmm. Same goes with work. Well, actually, I never hear anything about a work in a homily, right? Like, most of us spend most of our time at work and it's never mentioned in preaching. And so, how do we uphold this? These are one of the spaces. The more that we raise this to attention, the more likely it is. It's also, I think, linked to baptismal identity in the Eucharist. Like, if I understand that my vocation is to sanctify every crack and crevice of the world, then I'm going to live an integrated life, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to live that integrated life from the beginning, and I'll fail at it like a lot, but that's why there's confession.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. And you've mentioned so many great people, JP2, I said that earlier, but I'm curious, do you have any other one, anyone else, any particular church teachings or thinkers or, you know, saints, church doctors that you would recommend to even like fathers of families or just, you know, anyone who's interested to help reflect on their role, that unified role within the church and within communities?
Yeah, I mean, I have this sort of little article I've assigned over the years. It's especially for dads. It's on fatherhood. It's by this philosopher from the 20th century, Gabriel Marcel. It's a tough read, but Gabriel Marcel sort of notes that particularly in the 20th century, there was a kind of giving up of fatherhood. And this was also politically, like we began to wish that there were fewer children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's especially addressing this sort of question of, you know, what does it mean to be a dad and even biologically to be a dad? And dads, of course, always have a different kind of relationship with their kids. They didn't carry their kids in their wombs. And so he sort of notes that it's always an act of adoption, right? It's always an act of adoption, of choosing, of giving your will over to this work. I think it's really helpful for young men who often don't think one day about being dads. So this has been a really important work for me. There's an equivalent work that a number of women I've worked with have found beautiful. Natalie Carnes, who's a theologian now, who's moving to Duke. I don't think she's Catholic, but she's married to a Catholic. And she has this great book through Stanford University Press that is a much easier read called Motherhood, A Confession. And it's Augustine's Confessions rewritten based upon her own identity as a mother. And you can just see how she comes to recognize the presence of God in her family life and all this means for her work life and her social life. So it's a really stunning work. So Natalie Carnes, Motherhood, and this short article by Gabriel Marcel on fatherhood.
Perfect. We'll include both of those in the show notes. And to kind of just round about the conversation, I'm curious, what gives you kind of, I mean, you see a lot of undergrad students, 200, that's a lot of kids. What's like your hope for the future generation, the next generation of Catholic families that you either can see in the midst of your own students, but, or also just that you pray for and just hope for the next generation?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging. I think my hope is that we as a society come to recognize how important raising a family is for the social order. And, you know, a lot of families that are poor or on the margins or enduring suffering, they are struggling so much with just keeping things together. Mm-hmm. But they don't possess that kind of social support that is often needed, whether that's from parishes, from the government, right? It's sort of, you know, do it on your own and, you know, see what happens. Mm-hmm. Or they're like many of my undergraduates on the opposite end of the spectrum, extremely wealthy, mm-hmm. and yet, you know, chase their first thing they want to chase is their career and their, you know, that's what they want. And there's all sorts of things they've been introduced to that I find false narratives. They've been taught that, you know, having a kid, you know, that young women in particular have been taught that like having children will make it impossible to have a career. And so you have to put that off for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And they're partially right. I mean, they're entering sort of careers like medicine or law or business where they would be punished for having a child, right? Punished relative to their salary, punished relative to future roles. And I guess my hope is that these young people I'm working with can start to create the political world where that kind of support of family life as integral to human flourishing and happiness, not accidental, not a private thing we do, but integral to what it means to be human, that they don't have to make that decision. They've set up systems where there is that support from beginning to end. They run companies where they give maternity and paternity leave right away instead of being like, well, I'm sorry, you're not going to be able to take this. Mm-hmm. They're bosses, right? Who, when someone comes in and says, hey, my kid's really struggling with depression, I'm sorry, I'm struggling with work, that say like, okay, how about you take care of that? How do I help you take care of that? Like, that's the kinds of things I want. And that creates a culture where it's easier to have families and to engage in this public witness. So I guess that's my big, really big, super big political hope.
Yeah, well, that's a great hope. I hope for that too. That would be perfect. What are you working on now that, you know, is there anything exciting that you have up in the works? So you're almost done with the school year. Maybe you are finished already, but curious what else you can share with our audience.
Yeah, so I'm done with the school year, but one of the cool parts of working at my institute is that we actually ramp up again for the summer. So not only do I work with students on campus, but work with continuing education students throughout the United States, and as well as master's students in the summer who are coming in to take classes for that period of time. So, you know, I think what's exciting for me is that, you know, we have a number of projects that we're working on with these folks. I'm very interested in this project I'm working on. It arose from a grant that we got on related to children and worship. So how do we help children worship, young children in particular, worship the Lord better in our age? And, you know, I think in our research and our study, we realized that the problem is really a loss of wonder. And the problem isn't the young child, but the adults around the young child that have turned their lives basically into a moving treadmill of measurement and assessment. And so, you know, I'm working on a number of projects linked around this, but I've been thinking about it in terms of like starting a contemplative revolution. You know, how do we slow down, teach slower, exist more slowly, operate more slowly? And if we can do that, you know, what can we do to change so much of what's going on in social life today? So, yeah. I guess like what I'm working on now, I'm working on it through books and articles and teaching, but it's an area that's attracted my attention over the last 6 months, this contemplative revolution.
Yeah. Well, that sounds amazing. We'd love to touch base with you on that as you continue. That sounds, I feel like our parents and families would really love that too, how to build that devotion within their children. That's amazing.
Yes. No, it's been fun. I mean, if we can slow down, I think a lot of our problems are solved and, you know, and just say like, a lot of what we're doing is based on this sort of technocratic paradigm that Pope Francis talked about, where efficiency is the goal, and efficiency should not be a goal of human life.
Yeah.
Per se.
Right.
Though my granting agency, if they listen to this, I will be highly efficient with your use of funds.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Nice. Oh, well, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Dr. O'Malley, for being on our show and sharing your insights and just some incredible things that I'm sure our listeners will take with them and ponder and hopefully reflect on to build, you know, stronger virtue in their own family life.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2025, we are continuing to share the beautiful devotion to Mary, Mother of Ferris Love, while providing practical tools and advice for parents, couples, and families. You can help us with this mission by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovefamilyproject.org.